And rebuttal time for you.
Good morning. I would like to reserve 3 minutes. And,
all right, proceed.
May it please the court, Jason Anderson with Carney Badley Spellman on behalf of the appellant Nathan Brassfield. Reversal is necessary in this case mainly because the finding of a history of acts of domestic violence was not supported by substantial evidence. And I want to begin by addressing the statutory definition of domestic violence in RCW 2650.010 subsection 3, because the trial court's failure to apply that definition is the central reason we're here today. And the definition is part of the Domestic Violence Prevention Act, but it's also incorporated in other statutes, including the Sentencing Reform Act and, pertinent here, the Parenting Act. And it's very clear in terms of identifying the conduct that constitutes domestic violence. In this case, it's undisputed that Mr. Brassfield never caused physical harm to any family member, including Ms. Rainbow. So as a result, the only part of the definition that can even arguably be at issue is infliction of fear of imminent physical harm. Mr. Brassfield has maintained throughout this case that such infliction never occurred, and no evidence was presented to suggest otherwise. Under a plain meaning analysis of the definition, it's useful to analyze its four elements. And the first element is infliction. The word infliction necessarily denotes intentional conduct because parental rights cannot be restricted, nor criminal penalties imposed for that matter, based on mere inadvertence. Had the legislature meant to include unintentionally caused fears, it would have used the word caused rather than infliction.
Here we have the taking of the vehicle. We have at least verbal threats. You're not arguing those were unintentional acts, are you?
I would argue that those are not intended to inflict fear of physical harm.
Let's drill this down a little bit, because before you were talking about unintentional acts or behavior that wasn't volitional, it seemed. So are you saying that the intent has to be beyond something more than the intent to act in the way that you're acting?
It has to be intended that there be fear on behalf of the...
So if I shoot a gun at you and I don't intend to scare you, but you're scared because you know I've never shot a gun at a live person before, that doesn't meet your test, does it?
I think it could meet the test, and you know, here that's far beyond any factual scenario.
That's why it's a hypothetical. I really wouldn't shoot a gun at you. Do we really envision that's the type of thing that the legislature had in mind?
Well, the definition, I think the definition has to be interpreted narrowly in terms of the conduct that comes within the definition, because for one thing, the resulting restrictions infringe upon the protected interest of parents in the care, custody, and control of their children. Restrictions are based on acts of domestic violence, and each act has to be satisfy the definition, and it has to be an infliction of fear of imminent physical harm. If you're shooting a gun at someone,
Is there an objective component?
Yes, I was going to get to the fear element, which is the fear has to be objectively reasonable under the circumstances, and of course, the circumstances are relevant in determining whether the fear was objectively.
When does the person have to have the fear? At the time of trial? Prior to the time of trial? What's the target?
Well, it has to be at the time it's inflicted, because...
Why?
Because...
If someone shoots a gun at me, and I don't know who did it, and then a month later I found out it was you, now don't I have, for the first time, a right to be fearful of you, whereas a month before I did not?
Well, I would agree, and that's when the fear...
That wasn't at the time of the fear. I was afraid...
When the first
gunshot went off. Then I was afraid for different reasons when I learned that it was you.
And I would say that's when the fear is inflicted at that point.
So when you learned who was doing it.
It could be.
So when there are these emails to third parties where he talks about acting in a damaging way toward her and towards the child, and she learns about that later on, that's when the fear was inflicted.
Well,
because she learned about it, and he intended to send the emails.
Well, in that case, there was no, I wouldn't agree that there was fear inflicted of imminent physical harm. She did learn about it, and you know, I would point out for one that.
Well, can it be an accumulation of events that give rise to the fear?
No, it can't.
First, I hear a gunshot. A month later, I learn it was fired by you. A month later, I learn that you have particular enmity toward me. When did that fear, my fear of you, really come home? When I learned of the particular enmity, when I learned that you were the shooter.
I think all of that.
What's the target?
I think all of that goes to whether there's an objectively reasonable fear in a particular circumstances. But there is no totality of the circumstances test. You still have to have an act of domestic violence defined as infliction of fear of imminent physical harm. And in this case, a general state of fear, such as found by the trial court, is not the same as a specific fear of imminent physical harm. So I'll take a little bit of my rebuttal time just to say, you know, this trial court knew, it's not as if this trial court was unaware of the correct legal definition. The trial court announced that the domestic violence includes coercive and controlling behaviors and is determined based on the totality of the circumstances. It's not, and Ms. Rainbow concedes that these issues were raised repeatedly below. It's only reasonable to conclude that this trial court was motivated to find domestic violence committed against Ms. Rainbow, thus demonstrating its bias, or at least an appearance of bias. The record is replete with indicators of bias, many detailed in our briefing and none specifically disputed. So we ask that a different judge be assigned to preside over the entry of a new parenting plan on remand. Given the trial court's errors, its order should be reversed and the case remanded for determination of how best to resume this important father-son relationship. Lastly, Mr. Brassfield should be awarded fees. Only he complied with RAP 18.1, and he never should have had to litigate these issues, which appear to have been raised in bad faith. And I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
All right. You'll have 2 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Laura Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the respondent in this matter, Lauren Rainbow. I want to take a brief moment and note what reversal would look like. Mr. Brassfield's in prison. So really we're talking about very, very small window of what could happen even if there was a reversal, namely whether he would have visits with the child in prison.
We're concerned with whether the court got it right and applied the right standard, because these restrictions once imposed are pretty long-standing.
I understand that, so I'll address that. What counsel has attempted to do with the Domestic Violence Protection Act is construe it very narrowly, and I noted that he focused on whether there was a cause of physical harm or an intention to cause physical harm, although the statute itself, the definition, isn't that narrow. In fact, it focuses on physical harm, the infliction of fear of imminent physical harm. It doesn't say intentional infliction. I think if you look at common domestic violence scenarios as a whole, there's a whole lot of things that happen that may or may not be intentional on the person who loses control, loses anger, has things happen for whatever reason, be it mental health issues. There's a lot of ways people can cause threats of imminent harm. But in this case particularly, we don't have to worry about that because he did make outright threats. He asked for those threats in an email, the one that he sent to his mother, about whether or not Ms. Rainbow should be killed, and I'm paraphrasing. He asked that message to be sent along to her while there was a protection order already in effect. This is intentional. There was a description of stealing the car, for example, he made a threat that something would happen. Even after the police talked to him, even after she called the police, he sent somebody to carry through on that threat. That's pretty intentional.
Okay, but a threat to take the car and taking the car are not threats of imminent physical harm. And you have to establish a history of acts, and if you're going to rely on a history of acts in which she was placed in fear, that fear has to be imminent and reasonable.
I may have slightly misspoken in my paraphrasing. His threat was that something would happen. What happened was that overnight somebody came onto the property and stole the car. So the threat was more broad. The threat of death was pretty specific. Now, there is a history that was outlined by Ms. Rainbow at trial. She talked about him throwing things out the window, him almost hitting other people with cars as part of road rage while she was pregnant and in the car, him almost running somebody over. But specifically with respect to her, he's carried through on specific threats he's made. He said something would happen. He went on Facebook, and that's part of the trial exhibit, and said that she was lucky that that's all that would happen. These are things that are made openly out to other people, and in an email, it's not vague at all. And he's demonstrated by sending somebody, we don't even know who, to her home in the middle of the night, that he would carry through on those threats. And I think there is a big difference between saying, you know
what? So the significance of sending someone else is that, well, was it that her knowledge that he was in a particular place gave her no repose because he had evidenced an ability to have third parties do ill to her?
Exactly. Because even though he's currently incarcerated, that leads to the same threat that he knows people who are willing to do things for him. And all he apparently has to do is ask, and they can do it pretty quickly. And that was a particular concern in this case, even despite his incarceration, that because she had helped FBI lead to his incarceration because of the severity of the facts at issue, there's a very large concern that he not only wants her dead, that he could send somebody to do something to her despite being incarcerated, and that he has admittedly said that he hates her, will never co-parent with her again, cannot trust her. And she's led to his incarceration. He has a lot of anger. In fact, the Guardian ad litem described it as venomous anger. So we're not talking about what I would think of as a more common situation with somebody who maybe makes an offhand threat. We're talking about somebody who is a, I think, 7-time felon who's in prison because of acts that she helped the FBI perform, who has threatened her generally in the past despite police involvement and carried through on the threats, who has made threats to his mother in writing about Ms. Rainbow and asked the message to be passed along. He has made threats on Facebook. So this isn't just a very narrow view that one time maybe he did something. This is very specific, and there's a very real concern that something would happen in the future. But I wanted to note a couple of other things. There was a question about whether it's infliction of fear over time, and I think absolutely. I think these things add up, especially in domestic violence situations. There's that relationship and that intimidation and fear that goes along with knowing somebody. And if you read through all of the things that happened since these parties got together, it has been a bit of a laundry list of, I'd say, intimidating, terrifying actions happening in this family over a period of years. And even just understanding from Mr. Brasfield's own perspective, his statements to the informant that it doesn't matter what the government
has. Well, how should we construe this statute? I mean, do you have to have a threat of harm when it's imminent? Does it have to be within a discrete period? Or can you have a threat of imminent harm that is continuous?
I think you can have, well, to answer the first part of the question, I think it should be construed somewhat broadly because the statutes were enacted to stop the domestic violence cycle and to provide protection, not to require victims to come in and have to really fight hard to prove every single little thing until the point where they're actually confronted at gunpoint and saying that's enough. But the second part of it is you can have fear that lasts over a period of time, and it doesn't necessarily mean that there's something specific happening. Like in this case, he's threatened her life. He's in prison. He sent somebody before. That can last over years, specifically because he's in prison and because there may be a period of time before he gets out and decides to do something. It may be that he decides to get access in the meantime to send something. So I think you can have that fear based on the severity of the action and what was threatened that can last over a period of time. It can happen at any minute. You could also have the same sort of threat that she saw in the beginning, which was, you know, drop child support, you're going to face some consequences. And again, I'm paraphrasing. And that very night is when somebody comes in and steals the vehicle. So I think, generally speaking, all of those facts need to be considered. But the point is to stop the cycle. Because there is a cycle of violence, it may not be active at the moment, but it may be recurring. And that's why it's important to halt it.
I think there's tension here because we have a crime of making a threat. We have the DV statute, which can give rise to criminal prosecution. But we're talking about a parenting plan, and I think the evidentiary standard is merely a preponderance, but it is a preponderance of evidence that the harm, the fear is of imminent harm. And I think that's the focus that troubles me, is do the acts here establish that there was a reasonable fear that harm was imminent?
I think so, because of the
history. By a preponderance.
By more likely than not, that he could send somebody at any moment to do something. And I'd also want to note that there was an agreed order. He signed an agreed order, agreed protection order, saying that he committed acts of domestic violence. And I wrote it down because he said, respondent committed domestic violence as defined in RCW 2650-010 and represents a credible threat to the physical safety of petitioner. So there's an issue here, too, about coming up after the fact, after he's already gained benefits from signing an agreed order.
What's your argument? That that's an admission?
Yes.
Or are you arguing that he's a stopped?
Well, both. He's definitely a stopped because he already took that position in the case.
Well, let's talk about that, though. But the cases seem to indicate that the simple existence of the order cannot resolve the matter for the parenting plan.
I understand that, and I think
that seems to eliminate the estoppel argument.
And I think that by signing an agreed order and foregoing a full protection order hearing, that he admitted as much, and he is not able to go back and undo that. But aside from that, the facts themselves, I mean, these are severe facts. I don't know that they happen most often in domestic violence cases, even in some of the worst ones. These are very severe facts with somebody who's demonstrated severe reach. And that's what I've got. Right. Thank you very much. We ask that the decision be affirmed.
Counsel refers to statements by Mr. Brasfield on Facebook where he was venting to friends, but with no expectation that his thoughts in this private format would be communicated to Ms. Rainbow.
How do we know that?
Well, it's in the record that this was a private forum, and besides, thoughts are not domestic violence.
So there's a finding that nobody ever finds out about what somebody else puts on Facebook?
Well, people can find out about it, but these weren't threats. These were thoughts. These were expressions of frustration. These were not threats. There was no threat of death. There's a reference to death threats. The email to his mother actually said that while he'd had, certain thoughts about Miss Rainbow, he never actually could harm her. He told his mother that in this message. There was no expectation that she would ever say anything other than that to Ms. Rainbow. I would also point out
Was the court required to look at that in that way?
It's not required. It is required not to view it as a threat of death when it actually says, I could never harm her.
Why is the court required to view it in that way?
Because there's no other reasonable way to view it.
Sure, there is. I intend to kill her, but I'm a career criminal and I know better than to actually not put in my disclaimer.
Well, he didn't say he intended to kill her.
Well, I intended to give her a great deal of fear.
Well, it didn't.
I mean, you seem to indicate that this has to be everything has to be taken literally. That doesn't make
it. It doesn't have to be taken literally, but it didn't say anything that could be construed as a death threat. And I would also point out the court did not actually find that any of
these. Not going to co-parent with her anymore. What's the alternative to co-parenting?
It's not killing her or committing best. It's not.
Well, if he still wants to parent her and he doesn't want to co-parent her, where does that leave us?
I think we're getting. Are we getting away from the issue of domestic violence?
Or? No, you're talking about what could reasonably be viewed from the messaging. If there's only two parents and one of them doesn't want to be in a co-parent relationship anymore, and that parent wants to continue parenting, what are the inferences to be drawn?
It depends what how you interpret cope. I just don't think there's any reasonable inference to be drawn that he's intending that she, that Ms. Rainbow, have fear of imminent physical harm from a letter to his mother that says he could never harm her. Whether he can co-parent or not, again, that's a statement to his mother. Clearly, he wants to be a co-parent of his son. That's why we're here today. If I could just point out, lastly, the court didn't find that any of these statements or acts were domestic violence or that there was ever imminent physical harm.
Thank you, counsel. That'll conclude our hearing on that matter. And